Let me see your cool snake. Phrasing could have been better, but no. That is a cool looking snake.
Yeah.
Dead Boys. It's a podcast about the history and culture of death and decomposition. My name is Dorian. With me, as always, is Max. What's going on, Max?
I'm doing all right. Just had some tacos. They were fine.
Yeah, you had some gentrified tacos from the shitty shitty gringo chain that's been poisoning this city.
It's Father's Day, and my dad likes it.
Oh, all right. Well, that's fair. You gotta make some sacrifices for your dad on Dad's Day. What he wants to do.
I did that. Also, my car got broken into last night, and they took my prescription sunglasses, which I was really mad about. They also took, I have like 15 baseball cards in kind of my dash.
Uh-huh.
They took all of them but one, and I wonder why they left my Ozzie Smith card there. Maybe they're racist. I don't know.
Is he a minority? He's black. Yeah. He's a black man?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That joke went right over my head, although it wasn't a joke.
I don't know why my
conclusion from your story of how a crime was committed against you was, not your best joke, Max.
This racist person broke into my car. I do hope, though, that they try and put my prescription sunglasses on and then think they're cursed because they can't see with the sunglasses on. So, like, joke's on them.
I like that.
Assholes.
You're cursed now, idiot.
It's fucking junkies. Now I gotta, like, move to the suburbs. You live in an urban area and you get your car broken into once and then you're like, I gotta go to the suburbs now.
Never again. I will never allow a crime, no matter how petty, to be committed against me again.
Someone parks slightly in front of my driveway? No. I'm calling the cops.
Fuck all this. I gotta move somewhere safe, where the only problem is a crippling opioid addiction.
Yeah,
the suburbs.
God. Ohio suburbs.
Yeah.
I got bad news, because it doesn't really get much more chipper after this. We got kind of a bummer episode today, bud.
We do?
Yeah, a little bit.
Oh, okay.
I think it's gonna be cool. It's really interesting. I had a really good time with it.
Yeah, I'm surprised because I saw you put the subject of the episode in the show notes here. And I can't comprehend why they would be sad, but...
Yeah. Well, you know, we are going back into your territories today.
My territory?
Europe
territory?
That felt weird. We are going...
I don't know.
Today, we're going back into your territory.
Oh.
Art nerd territory.
I resent that, but okay.
Because today, we're going to be talking about death and photography. I think this may be a two-parter, too, because we got a lot of stuff.
Okay.
If it is a two-parter, we're going to be going to the old Civil War battlefields, and also modern battlefields.
Okay.
You know, doing a lot of combat war photography.
I love combat.
Yeah. Combat sports.
Civil War was my favorite combat sport.
So let's get into today's topic with the pre-Dead Boys crack into the topic moment. Today, it's mixing it up. What with the Giant Eagle Fruition? You ever had this?
No.
Let's crack into it. Ah, it's difficult to open that can.
Holy shit, how much sugar is in this? Zero?
None. Right? It's concerning.
What?
I got it because I thought it was a sparkling water, and it's not. Tastes like juice.
It does. It just tastes like straight juice. Straight soda. No calories? What's in this? Oh, aspartame.
Aspartame.
Fuck, dude.
I know, I'm sorry.
I have been poisoned. Avenge my death.
It's not really a sparkling water.
But it says it's advertised as sparkling water.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, that'll be fine.
That's very deceptive.
Giant Eagle is the only blight on the fair state of Pennsylvania. I love Pennsylvania. It's a great place. It's a wet drink.
Yeah.
A wet drink. Wet drink.
I like that you said that while wiping drops of it off of your laptop
screen. Well, you know, like LaCroix is kind of light, and this is just kind of wet and heavy.
Okay, yeah.
I feel like I'm gleeking a lot now.
Yeah, yeah. I'm drenched now. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Sorry.
No, I'm just kidding.
So with all that out of the way, let's hop in the old time machine, and we're going to head back to the Civil War to meet one Matthew Brady.
I was excited that you were going to say Matthew Broderick.
Matthew Broderick. Now, Matthew Brady is typically considered, he's the guy that gets, you know, credited with popularizing photography, specifically because he created photojournalism. For centuries, we had newspapers. But for some, like, really dumb reason, they never had photographs in the articles. Because old-timey people, I guess, were just stupid. And they were like, oh, well, George Washington just signed the Declaration of Independence. And let's just not take a photo of it and put it in the paper. But I would really like to have that.
I mean, did they have the technology? Did they have the means and the budget to have photography back then? I don't know if it was a question of them being stupid.
I think they were just too lazy to invent it, is what happened.
I like that anytime we talk about something and there's some culture that just doesn't do something current, like with the internet and cell phones, you're like, they were too stupid to realize they could just get on Amazon and buy one.
All like the history stands are like throwing their phones across the room right now and are just, we lost like 40 subscribers.
Yep.
Because of that joke.
Damn.
It's dumb. So, this is a word I didn't know how to say until I wrote it in this article. So, I know daguerreotypes weren't invented until the 1840s.
Is that how you pronounce that word? Daguerreotype.
Yeah. Daguerreotype.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't pay attention
right? to that. Right? It was a thing that I looked at all forever and was like, I don't fucking know how to say that word.
It might be the single coolest looking word.
Yeah. Daguerreotype.
Dog-erotype.
Daguerreotype.
Woof.
So, I know that daguerreotypes weren't invented until the 1840s. But, you know, whatever. Matthew Brady was one of the first guys to popularize their use in journalism, specifically because of the Civil War. So here's some background info on him.
Brady was born on May 18th, 1822, in Warren County in upstate New York, although he claimed to have been born in Ireland.
Brady had a bit of a habit of enhancing the truth. We're going to see that as we go.
Okay.
The truth enhancer.
A liar.
Yeah.
At age 16, Brady became the student of nationally famous portrait painter William Page. A year later, Brady and Page would move to New York City together and study with Samuel Morse, who, in addition to inventing the telegraph, was one of the first photography artists in the United States. In 1850, Brady was 28 years old and had already photographed many famous Americans, including former President Andrew Jackson and Edgar Allan Poe. However, as the dawn of the American Civil War approached, rent in New York City began to increase rapidly. Brady became pressed for money and had the brilliant idea of marketing the carte de visite.
I know we give old-timey people a lot of grief on this show, and I did it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But this dude, like, at age 16, was like, I'm going to move to New York City.
Nice.
And then I'm going to, like, take Edgar Allan Poe's picture while hanging out with the guy who both invented the telegraph and photographs. Which is wild.
William Page did? Or wait, Samuel Morse.
That's God. Like Morse code.
Oh, I'm an
it's
idiot.
Named after him.
Yeah, of course. Damn. Wow.
Isn't that wild? Yeah, he like popularized photography in the United States and also invented the telegraph.
Yeah. Yeah, man, nothing makes me feel like a piece of shit for being 30 years old than reading things like this.
I took Obama's picture once with my iPhone.
Did you
at
really?
A rally, yeah.
Oh, wow, nice.
I was, you know, like 500 feet away and...
So he's a speck on your
yeah,
iPhone
Yeah, he's like a tiny
4.
Little blip, yeah. But, you know, I took former President Barack Obama's photo.
Yeah, so you're basically the same as Matthew Brady.
Yeah. Very, very offensive. So the carte de visite was Brady kind of starting to grind a little bit. And it was really when he started getting into war photography, which he became known for. So a carte de visite was like a personal trading card. you would get your photo taken by a photographer, and then that photo would be printed on a tiny little piece of paper, and then that paper would be glued to a piece of cardstock.
Hmm.
So this allowed for, you know, basically like wallet-sized photographs. Like when you have school picture day.
Yeah.
Little, you get the, yeah.
Well, 2x3s or whatever.
Yeah. So rich people would just have those sitting around their house so that if you visited them, you would remember what they looked like, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
And it was pretty cool because a lot of the cards would feature like Abraham Lincoln or Sojourner Truth. And a lot of the time, those, the more trading-based ones...
Mm-hmm. The holographic rares.
Yeah. They were sold to raise money for abolitionist movements in the North.
Oh, cool.
Which is cool. So you would go buy, like, the new holofoil Sojourner Truth card, and then the money you paid for that would go to free some slaves.
Just cool. Damn. Makes me feel real stupid, the amount of money I spent on Pokemon cards growing up.
Yeah, how many... What good things did you do with those?
I don't know. I probably didn't support anybody's righteous endeavors by buying a holographic Charizard.
Got a couple artists off the ground.
Yeah, hopefully.
A fun aside for the carte de visite, though, was that some folks treated them like early memes.
Okay.
So, like, if you did something that was weird, like if you were like a sideshow guy, you could sell a card with your photo on it so that people could brag about having seen you.
Hmm.
So I did find some really good photos of them online, including maybe the first ever cat meme. So this man, A. Kirpin.
Yeah.
It's just a photo of him sitting in like an ottoman, and it says, A. Kirpin, beard 8 feet long, 11 years growth.
That's amazing. It's like a whip. It's like, yeah, a whip at the end.
It's really gross.
It's all ratty.
He doesn't even look that old. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe 40s, 50s, I don't know.
Yeah.
Handsome guy.
You want to get into the cat one?
Yeah, I do. There's three cats. They're all kind of looking toward the photographer expectantly as they are seated surrounding a plate. And written on the bottom of the photo is, bring up the dinner, Betsy.
It's like, I guess that's a meme. I guess people thought that was funny for some reason.
Yeah, well, they were still in the lab working on Hang in There, Cat.
Yeah. The first good cat meme.
They had to make some bad. For every good meme, there are 1,000 or many more bad memes.
Yeah.
And they got to make the bad memes first.
This one feels like a real clunker. Like, I don't understand what's funny about this.
Bring up the dinner, Betsy. I just assume it's really aggressive.
And yeah, and like, cats people are like, assholes. Oh, these cats are silly.
People are charmed by how grumpy and angry these cats are. Oh, damn. Before there was Garfield, there was Bring Up the Dinner, Betsy.
Bring the lasagna, John. These do matter, though, because when Matthew Brady was kind of grinding, he was exploiting the oncoming Civil War to sell these things.
In the late 1850s, just before the dawn of the Civil War, Brady began running ads in New York newspapers specifically targeted at the families of young men who had enlisted in the military. Brady sold a single card for $1, which, adjusted for inflation, comes out to about $28. His advertising regularly included the phrase, "You cannot tell how soon it may be too late."
It's heavy stuff for a medium that started as a cat meme.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was basically making these Memento Mori trading cards.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you know, granted, at this point, you may only get 2 photographs of someone in their whole life. So if they're about to go off to war, that's probably a good time for you to get a picture of them.
Yeah.
Eventually, though, Brady does get bored with just selling these Memento Mori trading cards, and he wants to do something bigger. So in 1861, which was the first year of the American Civil War, Brady built a mobile food truck. Brady built a mobile photo studio and hit the road to document death at battle sites around the nation.
Brady started his war photography by documenting the first battle of Bull Run in July of 1861. He was almost captured during the battle and came under direct fire during this and many subsequent battles. The danger would eventually lead to Brady operating out of a home studio in Washington, D.C., and hiring a mobile staff of assistants to do most of the photography. In October 1862, Brady opened an exhibition of photographs from the Battle of Antietam in his New York gallery titled The Dead of Antietam. Many images in this presentation were graphic photographs of corpses, a presentation new to America. This was the first time that many Americans saw the realities of war in photographs, as distinct from previous artists' impressions, which frequently depicted valiant battles and noble deaths.
Yeah, so here we're getting into it. Up till now, Matthew Brady has kind of just been like, just taking photos of normal stuff. Here's where he starts getting really into taking photos of dead people, which is where it kind of overlaps with what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, to his credit, even though Brady started his career by roughly exploiting people, I don't know.
Hmm. Are you talking about the, like, military portraits being exploitative? Yeah, I guess so.
There's a bit of a scare factor in there.
Yeah.
Even though he started doing that, he really helped the public perception of war to evolve from, like, gentlemanly pseudo-sport, where you just kind of walked out on a line and shot at everyone and then said, good show.
Yeah, it's valiant, it's respectable, it's honorable.
Yeah, he changed the perception to be what it actually is. Like, graphic, you know? Because history is not only written by the victors, but by the survivors.
Hmm.
Even if you're on the winning side of a war, at this time, if you get shot like 15 times with lead musket balls, and it takes you 6 hours to die on a battlefield, you don't get to make it back to tell your story.
Hmm. Yeah.
You don't get to inform people of what being in a battle is like. They just know the stories of the people who are like on the horses in the back and survived, you know?
Horses in the back.
Horses in the back.
Horse tack is attached.
Turned around and gave that big booty a smack.
Oh, I was going with an Old Town Road reference.
That's
but,
what, I was doing a little crossover there.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
A little mashup.
Yeah, so, you know, history does need to be told by people who didn't have it so well. And this is what Brady started doing. The Civil War killed a lot of people. Because war kills a lot of people, usually, you know.
What?
You're, like, spitting your fruition out. It's, like, sticky.
No, that's not why I'm spitting my fruition out.
So, at this time, photography still required people to be very, very still. So it was really tough to get a photo of an active battle. So the best subjects for Brady to photograph were corpses.
Yeah.
One of the most famous shots he took was from the Battle of Gettysburg and is titled Home of a Rebel Sharpshooter. But before we get into the photo, gotta throw in a little caveat, because you, being an artist, I'm sure know how poorly people treat artists sometimes.
Yes, this happens.
Brady wasn't any different. After the first couple battles, he kind of just hung out in D.C. and sent his employees to take a bunch of photographs. And then when they would send them back to him in D.C., he would just write, photographed by Matthew Brady, and sell it as his own work. He's on like a Thomas Kincaid grind or like a James Patterson thing.
Yeah, it's real. It's really capitalizing on tragedy.
Yeah.
Ugh.
So this Home of a Rebel Sharpshooter photo was probably taken by a guy named Alexander Gardner. But a lot of the photos that you see from the Civil War that are Matthew Brady originals probably weren't actually him. But Dorian, take a look at this photo.
Oof, okay. It's,
What are you seeing here? What are the feelings that it evokes in you?
It's pretty sad. There's a single corpse in the middle of, looks like some stone walls. Is this like a trench that was used for combat?
This is at Gettysburg, mm-hmm. And Gettysburg has, I've stood there. It's got some like rising hills that have kind of crags on them.
Okay.
And so people would pile stones up between the crags and then shoot from them.
Okay.
They were like early snipers.
Okay, kind of like battlements, like they're building the cover to use while they're shooting other people.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and this guy's rifle is propped up against the pile of rocks and he is laying dead right in the center of the frame.
Yeah, it's pretty bleak. Like there's nothing else going on in this photo. It's just a dead guy.
It's definitely not heroic, like mid-battle. I see the point that was made about the paintings where it's mid-battle. These all of these action heroes mid-stride.
Yeah, and people are charging forward and there's a flag. And
right, it looks real badass and admirable.
Yeah.
There is nothing badass or admirable about this. It's just very solemn and quiet and sad.
Yeah. So, I mean, imagine you're an old-timey person. You've never seen a photo before in a newspaper. You may have never seen what real warfare looks like. And you open your morning newspaper and you see this, you would be shocked.
Yep.
You know, maybe you just kind of assumed that bodies disappeared after a battle or went away.
Yeah, I thought they blinked for a little bit, for a second or two, and then didn't exist anymore.
You just respawn.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about that later, because that also plays into how we understand war and death.
Ooh, okay.
It's really interesting. But if you thought that one was jarring, you'd probably really be upset by this next one. This one's a little harder to see, but Matthew Brady actually took this one, and it's titled Confederate Dead Behind a Stone Wall at Fredericksburg, Virginia.
Yeah, so there is the wall made of stones, and then running along that wall, the big old long wall, is a little dugout, little trench sort of situation, and it's just kind of polka dotted with bodies up the entire stretch. And rifles. It's a lot of dead people.
Yeah. It's just not glorious or glamorous, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say, same sort of thing. It's just sad and quiet and solemn. There's nothing about this that makes me think it would be cool to be here, you know?
Yeah.
Like, oh man, how exciting a place to be.
Yeah. I want to grow up to be a career soldier.
Yeah.
You know?
No thanks.
Now, this photo really would have shocked contemporary viewers. A lot of us have seen photos like this before, especially from the Civil War. But, and this is, you know, this is where we're going to get a little fun. We can goof with this. Something to remember is that at the start of the Civil War, a lot of people thought it was going to be over, like, really quick. People were like, oh, we're just going to burn right through this. It's going to be fine.
Just going to have a quick war, real quick.
A pleasant little war. What I've got here is a Smithsonian report about the first battle of Bull Run, which was the first land battle of the Civil War. And it really underscores how, especially in the North, people just did not take the Civil War seriously at all.
Really?
Yeah.
Nobody realized that the battle fought at Bull Run on July 21st, 1861, was going to be remembered as the first gory conflict in a long and bloody war. Bull Run, the first land battle of the Civil War, was fought at a time when many Americans believed the conflict would be short and relatively bloodless. In fact, many civilians traveled to watch it, and many even brought food and even picnic baskets to watch the battle. It's not totally certain how many onlookers from Washington took to the area around the battlefield at Bull Run to watch a Union army made up of very green recruits. We do know, however, that those recruits were all volunteers who had signed up to Lincoln's army for a 90-day term, because it was thought the war would be over that fast. A Union captain named John Tidball later wrote that he saw a throng of sightseers near his position. Tidball later described a crowd of men eager to watch the battle, along with a few enterprising saleswomen who brought pies and other pastries to sell. Quote, "It was Sunday, and everyone seemed to have taken a general holiday, that is, all the male population."
Very, very silly.
Yeah.
People just kind of rolled up to this with picnic baskets.
You want to buy a pie?
Just selling pies? Like, can you imagine how weird that would be?
Yeah, like in a conflict in the Middle East, there's assault rifle fire and drones exploding people, and you're like,
just sitting on a hill and watching it.
You want to buy some donuts?
Right? It's very strange. The even worse part is that the Union army just got stomped here.
Yeah.
Because they were not taking anything seriously at the time.
Damn. Yeah, so they probably not only thought it would be short, but that it would be an easy victory. We're just going to squash out this rebel faction.
Yeah.
And that'll be the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, these guys were just teenagers who rolled up here and were like, yeah, we're all fighting this war. It's going to be really quick.
Yeah.
They got stomped. And Tidball actually goes on to describe civilians, quote, "fleeing in colliding carriages, tearing away wheels. Horses were cut loose and ridden without saddles, further trampling the bodies of the dead and wounded. So, like, it was a rough scene because people were just, like, dumb. And we're like, this will be a nice thing to do on a Sunday.
Yeah, you're right about this one. They were pretty dumb in this situation.
It feels almost like people showing up to watch a football game. Something like that.
Yeah. You know, we've kind of grown up with there's always a war somewhere at all times during our entire lives. So, I don't know. We're also kind of post-Vietnam, and we're living after all of these very huge public spectacles of war being awful. That, yeah. So I guess I can, at least in theory, kind of put myself in their shoes and think, yeah, this is just a game or a sport to watch. Like, yeah, people die. That's awful. But, you know, they had it coming to them. They're the bad guys or something like that.
It's, you want to shoot up. You want to show up and, like, cheer for the good guys.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
I think a lot of people genuinely thought this was going to be, like, the battle. And it that just, the North would win. And then they would be like, great job, guys. And then they'd make, like a soccer tunnel.
Yeah. Remember that one time they had a civil war?
That's kind of what people expected it to be like.
Yeah.
You know, the scenes of all these people being trampled and stuff like that, that's what Matthew Brady and early war photographers wanted people to see. They wanted people to see chaos, and they wanted people to not hide behind viewing war as sport or something that gentlemen did in a pristine battlefield. When Brady ran his first exhibition of Civil War photographs in October 1862, a New York Times article wrote the following about the exhibition.
Mr. Brady has done something to bring home to us the terrible reality and earnestness of war. If he had not brought bodies and laid them in our dooryards and along the streets, he has done something very much like it.
Yeah. So he introduced through photography what death was like. This was about the point in American history where we start pushing death out of mainstream life, especially in cities. If you lived in New York, cemeteries were out of town. If you lived in a major city, you didn't have like a neighborhood cemetery anymore.
It's kind of the out of sight, out of mind phase of Americans and their interactions.
Medicine's starting to get a little better, so people aren't just like dying constantly.
It doesn't need to be a daily part of life anymore, so why make it that way?
Yeah. And, you know, Brady wasn't perfect. Even though he wanted to do this, he legitimately has been accused of finding bodies and then dragging them into better scenes and, like, blocking a shot so that it looked more dramatic.
Okay, yeah.
Which is not great, but I don't know. Photography was expensive back then, and
yeah, I guess, you got to make sure the shot is right when you have only so much. Resources are very scarce when it comes to photography back then. They didn't have Fujifilm or your dang iPhone, Max.
But wouldn't that feel weird? Just like being like at work with your boss and your boss is like, hey, go grab that body and drag him like 40 feet over that way.
I'm at work here.
Yeah.
I guess that doesn't bug me nearly as much as just how he had to, like, scrawl his name over all of his products.
Yeah, that's shitty.
His product being photographs of dead people.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a bad look.
I'm sure at the time he just did it without a second thought, but it's just, it's kind of grody.
Just not cool.
Just shallow and capitalistic to kind of be like, oh, dead people. I'm going to make so much money off of this.
Yeah. People are going to be really upset by this.
Right.
As war evolved, however, a lot of photojournalists end up following in Brady's footsteps and brought the reality of war back to America, specifically by photographing death. And as you mentioned, we've been super lucky here in the States where we haven't had a war on our soil in centuries since the Civil War.
Right.
There was like fighting in Alaska in World War II, which is very silly. And you like don't think about that. But Japan invaded Alaska at one point.
Did they really?
Yeah. It's very silly. It did not go well for them.
Really? Alaska fought them off?
Yeah, they had a whole military base up there, and it did not go well.
Oh, wow.
For the Japanese. But
I did not know that.
Yeah. I didn't know about that until I started looking into this. But as you mentioned, too, during the Vietnam War, photojournalists were really fixed on capturing death and the horrors of war and showing that to an American audience. Have you seen the photo of Kim Phuc? The little girl who's like running from her village.
Yeah, where she's just been burned with napalm. And
yeah.
Mm, yeah.
That is genuinely one of the most difficult photos to look at.
Yeah.
It's really bad. She survived, and she's doing humanitarian work in Canada now, which is cool.
Yeah.
But especially around Vietnam, photojournalists wanted people to see death that war was causing. Because even though we live comfortably through war, a lot of people don't.
Yeah.
You know? That brings us to the story of Kenneth Jarecki. I listened to him say his name. It's spelled J-A-R-E-C-K-E. And I was like, oh, Kenneth Jarek. Dresky.
Dresky?
Jarecki.
Jarecki?
Jarecki.
Is it Polish, perhaps?
I guess, yeah.
Huh, all right.
My people. So that brings us to the story of Kenneth Jarecki and his infamous photograph of the Gulf War. Do you know about this?
I don't think so.
Okay. So both of us are too young to remember the Gulf War. Very early 90s. But at the time, it was, like you mentioned earlier, it was the video game war. Like, you know, planes were just dropping bombs, and America went to the Middle East and had night vision.
Mm.
And there were precision strikes.
Right, this was the era where we had a bunch of new toys and weapons that...
Yeah, we hadn't used for a while.
Yeah, we wanted to play with and would just kind of start wars.
Yeah. You know, a lot of the people stateside were like, oh, we're kicking ass over there. This is awesome.
Mm.
America had, I think, less than 300 casualties over the whole war.
Wow.
And half of them were non-combat deaths. And this is, too, where we start seeing a shift in photography. Photographs went from dead bodies to mechanical wreckage and toppled statues. And that's a lot easier to stomach than a dead person, you know?
Yeah.
Infamously, this was also the war when the military released Desert Storm trading cards.
Yeah.
I didn't really know about this, so I don't know if people abroad will know about this, but they were like trading cards with like tanks on them. Yeah. And you would collect them.
Yeah, I think this was at the height, too, of like collectible trading cards extended beyond baseball and some other niches, and it was like everything was just starting to have trading cards in the early 90s. Yeah. I didn't collect these. I was real big on X-Men trading cards.
Oh, yeah. Those were a thing.
Basically the same thing, right?
Yeah. Weapon X.
Yeah. Was Weapon X, the Weapon X program, wasn't that part of Desert Storm?
Yeah. They had Wolverine go out into the Kuwait.
Jesus.
So this cavalier attitude with trading cards and all that stuff, people didn't like that. Rub some people the wrong way.
I wonder why.
Yeah. Especially reporters who had to see this stuff firsthand and see the military just be like, don't take photos of that. Just take a photo of this statue that fell over.
Hmm.
You know? So Kenneth Jarecki, who might be like a pre-Dead Boys hero after this episode, he decided to do something about it. At this point, we're going to start quoting from a really fantastic Atlantic article by Tori Rose DeGette. And we'll post this article after we're done. It's remarkable. But here's how the story's set up.
The Iraqi soldier died attempting to pull himself up over the dashboard of his truck. The flames engulfed his vehicle and incinerated his body, turning him to dusty ash and blackened bone. In a photograph taken soon afterward, the soldier's hand reaches out of the shattered windshield, which frames his face and chest. The colors and textures of his hand and shoulders look like those of the scorched and rusted metal around him. Fire has destroyed most of his features, leaving behind a skeletal face fixed in a final rictus. He stares without eyes. On February 28, 1991, Kenneth Jarecki stood in front of the charred man parked amid the carbonized bodies of his fellow soldiers and photographed him. At one point before he died, this dramatic mid-retreat death, the soldier had a name. He'd fought in Saddam Hussein's army and had a rank and an assignment and a unit. He might have been devoted to the dictator who sent him to occupy Kuwait and fight the Americans. Or he might have been an unlucky young man with no prospects, recruited off the streets of Baghdad.
Yeah, and there's the photo.
Wow.
It's jarring.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Like, that's the opening paragraph to this Atlantic article that highlights this photo, and it's not like a, it's not really an overstatement.
Yeah.
But this photo never made it stateside during the war.
Really?
Really. Time Magazine and the Associated Press, who Dresky worked for, refused to publish this image and, quote, denied the public the opportunity to confront this unknown enemy and consider his excruciating final moments. And, like, granted, you can see why a magazine would refuse to publish this.
Yeah, kind of, you know, more to do with they don't want to upset them with an offensive photo. I get that.
Yeah, but this was also a war where we were just kind of carpet bombing everybody.
Yeah, it kind of calls into question, too, like, what is the point of Time Magazine and all these publications if it's not to accurately report on things going on in the world? Is it just to kind of put nice things together for people to consume? Are they content creators?
Yeah.
Oh shit, I just just gave up the farm, huh?
Well, ironically, this is where editors kind of become political tools. And the editor of Time Magazine is actually quoted in this article and says some really interesting things about their decision process in this.
Stella Kramer, who worked as a freelance photo editor for Life on 4 special edition issues on the Gulf War, said that the decision to not publish Jureski's photo was less about protecting readers than preserving the dominant narrative of the good, clean war. Quote, "The magazines were very sanitized. That's why these issues are all basically just propaganda." She points out the picture on the cover of the February 25th issue, a young blonde boy dwarfed by the American flag he's holding. She remarks, "As far as Americans were concerned, nobody ever died."
Yeah. That's kind of the consequence of us pushing death further and further away from our culture as Americans.
Hmm.
We're super lucky to not have regular warfare going on here in the States.
Right.
But it's also really easy to forget that war is hell. I think when you kind of lose that awareness of what death means, and especially death by warfare, it, like she says, it really sanitizes the whole thing.
Yep.
And, you know, when it is violent, it's far away.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. It gets kind of flippant. But Jureski wasn't about to let his photo go without fighting it, to his credit.
Jureski recalls, "I could see clearly how precious life was to this guy, because he was fighting for it. He was fighting to save his life to the very end till he was completely burned up. He was trying to get out of that truck. If I don't take pictures like these, people like my mom will think war is what they see in movies."
Yeah. Jureski did end up losing his fight, and the Associated Press refused to publish this photo in U.S. newspapers, but it did run in multiple English newspapers, which helped turn public support away from the war. You know, it seems like a controversial photo, but I think it's important to kind of consider death in warfare and how that means we allocate our resources. And the best way to tell that story is through photography.
Hmm.
Jureski kind of summed that up in another photo defense by saying, quote, "If we're big enough to fight a war, we should be big enough to look at it."
Hmm.
And I think that's kind of the utility of war photography. It's kind of forcing us to look at what we've done in our name, or also what has been done. Because for a long time, there weren't photos of concentration camps in World War II. So people would hear rumors of what was going on over there, and they'd just be like, "Oh, that's probably not real."
Yeah, that sounds too awful to be true.
Yeah. And then when the photographs started coming out, it was like, oh boy.
Right.
Yeah.
It's interesting, too, that the point is not to shock people. It's not to have propaganda in the opposite camp.
Like, rah, rah, rah.
Or of, like, shaming people. Like, we should never have any kind of war or conflict ever. Like,
yeah.
Like, look at this and look at what you've done to these poor innocent people. It's not necessarily coming from that camp either.
No.
I like that philosophy of, if we're big enough to have a war, we should be big enough to look at it.
Yeah.
The whole point being, let's take an honest look at what is going on. And kind of reevaluate, like, what are we trying to accomplish here? Is it worth it? Because if this is a war just to try out new toys and puff up our economy, is it really worth this amount of destruction that you can literally physically see with your eyes in this photograph?
Yeah. I think that's because death is so poignant. It really forces that question. I think it's a really interesting thing to consider.
Absolutely. So it sounds like this is just going to be part one of death and photography.
It will be. And I know this is the heavy part. The lighter stuff will come in the next episode.
Fun.
It's going to get pretty fun. We won't do any war photography in that. And I would feel bad, too, talking about fun stuff after having talked about all this, which is important and really interesting.
Yeah.
And really overlaps a very cultural fear of death. But I would have felt bad talking about some of the stuff we're going to talk about right after this.
You, listener, did such a good job today powering through all this tough stuff. Make sure you check out, we're going to link to some photos in that Atlantic article for further information.
Yeah.
This is not the most fun topic, but really interesting stuff that I think is pretty important for us to consider. Especially, yeah. You know, if you're going to be death positive, you have to be like willing to take a look at some difficult things, death and war and otherwise.
Yeah.
So thank you for putting this together.
Yeah, you did
good. It wasn't too like oppressive or anything.
I think it helps that people used to be dumb enough to go like hang out with picnic baskets.
Yeah.
And watch a battle. We can make fun of them.
Yeah, those doofuses. Anyway, thanks for listening. We love hearing your thoughts, your comments, your questions on this or any other episode or any topic. You can email us predeadboys@gmail.com. Find us on Twitter or Instagram @predeadboys. And we got a Facebook group, just search Pre-Dead Boys Podcast. Cool stuff posted lately. Brittany from Lux Taxidermy.
So cool.
Posted some really cool shrunken fox heads that I guess she's been working on. She said that they're, you know, they're ethically sourced, I guess, in Australia.
Like yeah.
Yeah, I guess in Australia, they're a pest over there, which I can only imagine foxes being so overpopulated that they're pests.
Yeah.
It sounds adorable, but it's probably not.
Well, if you're trying to raise livestock, it makes sense that they would.
Yeah, they're a bad threat.
Yeah.
But she has some really cool photos that she was posting on there. And I don't know, just shout out to Lux Taxidermy. Look them up on Instagram.
I looked at her Etsy and she doesn't ship to America yet. So Brittany, please ship to America.
Dude, shipping from Australia to the States is so... Last thing I ordered from Australia was a t-shirt and I paid like $70 all told. It came with some stickers too. So it was like cool, but man... It was brutal.
Yeah.
So,
I imagine, too, getting a shrunken fox head through customs would probably not be the most fun thing.
Yeah. But if you're one of the people listening that is fortunate enough to live somewhere in Australia or somewhere else where the shipping costs are a little less crazy, definitely check out her work. A lot of really cool stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, that's just one of the many perks of talking to people on the internet and talking to people who listen to this show. Just seeing really cool projects like that and hearing from y'all. Speaking of hearing from y'all, if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or Stitcher, we will give you a shout out on this here segment of the podcast. For example, we got a new 5-star review on iTunes. Is that... It sounded like you...
This is doing a spit take because people keep leaving us good reviews.
Oh, I thought you were doing like a... like
no, it was a good one.
Like you hate take. You hate positive feedback.
Please validate me.
Well, you're in luck, Max. You're about to be validated by this user's name is My Other Body is a Withered Old Crone. And their review is titled My New Obsession. That's the title of the review, not like a cologne. My Other Body is a Withered Old Crone says, I just got turned on to this gem of a podcast a few weeks ago, and I've been binging ever since. My fiance keeps commenting, oh, are you listening to your death stuff again? And the answer is, inevitably, yes. Yes, fiance. Deal with it. Anyway, great hosts, awesome hot takes, good facts presented in an approachable way.
Aww.
Also, I feel represented in a special way, as I also hate the Beatles, and people act as if I said I thought Genghis Khan was a really stand-up guy. Thanks for reminding me.
That's pretty good.
I'm gonna rot. Thank you. And stand strong. We stand in solidarity with anyone who hates the Beatles. It's a dangerous time to be a Beatles hater.
Yeah.
You're gonna receive a lot of flack, but that's okay. Just live your truth.
It's really boring.
Yeah, live your truth. You don't need to see the movie Yesterday when it comes out in theaters. Like,
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, who cares? Who cares? Yeah, it's going to make money, but you don't need to see it. You don't need that kind of negativity in your
life. Go see Midsommar.
Did you see it?
No, but I'm really excited for it.
I was going to say, it's not out yet.
Not out yet.
Oh, man, you made my heart stop. I saw Hereditary in theaters. I think it was just three times.
Okay.
But, and I've seen it six or seven times since it came out last year. Needless to say, one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
Can't wait to see the weird summertime culty weirdness that Ari Aster makes with this film.
It looks like a good Wicker Man movie.
Yeah. The Wicker Man had a lot of promise, but it just doesn't really hold up.
No.
You know, my girlfriend and I watched Night of the Living Dead last night, and that's a movie that does still hold up.
Yeah.
But it is kind of amazing, like, how many movies just look really rote and unimpressive now because there's so many other movies that have riffed on that and
yeah.
done a better job
yeah.
with those elements. And The Wicker Man, unfortunately, is just, it was doomed to yeah. not age well. And by The Wicker Man, we are referring to the original that was released in, I believe, the 70s. We're not referring to the Nicolas Cage vehicle, which has a lot of very funny, bad acting and CGI.
The bees scene, even more of a clunker.
Not the bees! so good. Anyway, thank you guys for the positive feedback. We love hearing from
yeah.
y'all. If you want to support the podcast in other ways, too, we could use money. We like cash. We really appreciate cash. You can go to ko-fi.com/predeadboys and leave a little tip for us. Super fan, number one fan of the podcast, Evan Latch, bought us another coffee
oh.
on our Ko-fi page.
Thank you, Evan.
And this time he says, I really hope this money doesn't all go straight to more fizzy flavor fluids. Just kidding, I trust you both greatly. Yeah, funny about that. Looks like Max blew it on a bad one. Crash. We'll remedy that. Anyway, he also says, the three of us should see another hardcore punk show again. And then Dorian and I can make Max mosh this time. Yeah, we got to chuck you in the Knocked Loose pit, buddy.
Oh, I did not like that. That was scary. I saw Drug Church recently, and the Drug Church show was great.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They're a great band.
Incredible.
Evan says, keep being neat, dudes. PDB is so hot right now. Hell yeah.
Zoolander.
So hot right now. Anyway, thanks, Evan. You too can leave us some money on ko-fi.com/predeadboys. Or just tell friends about this podcast. Really, just
yeah.
any feedback we get from you, anytime you want to talk to us, it's always awesome. We love hearing
yeah.
from you guys. You're great.
Just say hi. Especially, like, anytime someone says hi and they're not from Columbus, I, like, lose my mind. I think it's the coolest thing.
I scream and yeah. giggle and tell all of my coworkers.
Yeah.
And they're like, what are you doing? Get back to work, you piece of shit. It feels good. Also, if you have not yet had a chance to check out Beyond the Dash...
Yes.
They put together some very good research on, what was it? Shit. Death
in the Southern United States.
Yeah.
You mean the stuff they're on now? Because they're like on their grind. They're putting out stuff every day.
Yeah, they're cranking out some awesome content. And Max was just, I keep wanting to say featured in an article, but it's
it
not an
quoted.
Article.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were quoted in an article.
Yeah.
Anyway, they're doing really cool work over at beyondthedash.com. Go check them out. Just a reminder that we've got the ceremony here for the Columbus Podcast Awards, where we find out if we won awards.
Yes.
I hope we won awards. That comes up August 25th at Gateway Film Center in beautiful Columbus, Ohio. We will be hanging out there. Come kick it and talk to us and mix it up with some other cool podcasts here in Columbus.
That's going to be the day after my bachelor party, so please speak quietly if you see me there, but I will still buy you a drink.
Nice.
So
yeah. Oh man, I can't wait. That's gonna be fun. It's gonna be a great weekend. Our intro and outro music is the song About Time by Brat Curse. Check them out at bratcurse.bandcamp.com. anyway, that's all I had. I'm like breathlessly fighting my way through all of the post show notes. I would really like to get a good healthy, like a salad or something, just to like to reverse all of the bad dietary decisions.
Can you get some good fiber in you?
Yeah, and I'm going to drink it with good water.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go. I'm sorry to keep roasting you for this.
It's bad.
Every time you've taken a sip, you've made a distractingly sour face.
Like,
no!
Like a dog returns to its vomit, I return to fruition.
All right, Max and Dorian here reminding you, you're going to rock. We'll be right back.
next time on Pre-Dead Boys.
We've got post-mortem casket photography. We got Wisconsin.
Oh boy.
Yeah, we got a lot of good stuff.